You are listening to the Pulse, Rod Murray's e-learning tech podcast, number
163. Hi, this is Rod Murray. Welcome back to my podcast. Well, that little piece was a clip from a song that was created by artificial intelligence. It's called Utopian Prince, and it's from Juke Deck. You can create your own futuristic AI music at Juke Deck. Give it a try. This podcast is sponsored by Inside Higher Ed, the online source for news, opinion, and jobs for all of higher education. I also invite you to follow me on Twitter. My handle is RodsPods. As always, I post links to all of the things we talk about on my show notes at www.rodspulsepodcast.com. Today, I'm very happy to present to you a recording of the keynote speech by Dr. Brian Alexander. He spoke at our recent U-Sciences eLearning 3.0 conference. I've known Brian for quite some time. In fact, I interviewed him for my podcast back in March 2016. Then we also talked about the future of education, but it was more in the context of his being the senior researcher for the New Media Consortium and the NMC's Horizon Report for 2016. Now, Brian, if you don't know, he's a researcher, futurist, speaker, writer, consultant, educator, and a homesteader. He is an internationally known futurist working in the field of how technology transforms education. And that's exactly what he was talking about for his keynote, which was entitled Academia Beyond Millennials, the Next Generation of Higher Education. He talks about the globalization of higher education, different changes and trends happening, demographic, macroeconomic, political, education trends, defunding of public universities, student loan debt, privacy in this post-Snowden world, trends in accessing, sharing, cognifying, and filtering, AI and automation, VR, AR, and mixed reality, and Internet of Things. I know each time I listen to this, I hear another great tidbit from his lips. I think you'll really enjoy it. In fact, this is one of the podcasts where I have a video version of it on YouTube, if you're not already watching this on YouTube. So it goes along with his slides. So if you're listening to this in your car, you might want to save this until you're in front of your computer and watch this on YouTube. And you can see the links on my show notes. So without further ado, here's my broadcast of Dr. Brian Alexander's keynote talk, Academia Beyond Millennials.
Can everyone hear me all right? Good. Well, who said no? That was brilliant. That gives you that cognitive exercise. Well, wait a minute. If they couldn't hear me, how could they hear me to say? It's a great thing to do if you want to like toss your speaker completely sideways for minutes at a time. I'm really glad to see everybody here. As a Vermonter, I'm pretty familiar with what your storms can do. In fact, I am still paying for recovery to one of our cars, which I managed to drive off-road in October, over trees and over live power lines, just to get through one storm. So I'm very, very glad to see all of you have survived it and have electricity. Those of you who aren't here, well, that's too bad. No, I'm very sympathetic. And I'm also glad that you made it here. For those of you who are on break, who took time away from your busy schedule of breaking to come here. And for those of you who are at work, I'm really glad to see you here. Quick show of hands. How many of you are on Twitter? Oh, very good. How many of you are tweeting right this second? Oh, I don't believe it. please tweet away. If you want to tweet at me, my handle is Brian Alexander, one word, Brian with a Y. I'm not going to tweet right now while I'm talking. I try that sometimes, but it doesn't always work, but I will catch up with you. I also want to thank Rod, because he has done a tremendous amount of work to make this happen, including putting up with the storm at the Weather Channel called The Wrath of God, putting up with my insane travel schedule, and just bring everything together. So I want to thank him for that. He's also a fine podcaster and video maker, so if you haven't seen those outputs, you really, really should. What I'd like to do is ask you one more question. How many of you are full-time faculty members? How many of you are librarians? Just one? Okay, you have to stand up for everybody else now, just so you know. That's a good beard. Keep it coming. How many of you are in the instructional design, instructional technology world? That's a clear sign. And how many of you are in the IT world but aren't doing instructional design or academic computing? Very good. Very good. Welcome. Okay, that helps a lot. I'm not going to act as though you were all board members. As we proceed, I'm going to cover a lot of ground in a hurry. Please, summon up questions and comments. If you're using Glisser, which is a lot of fun, please put comments and questions there. If you're on Twitter, please share them there. I want to hear from you and see how we go. We have time for questions and discussion at the end, and as you'll see, I'm much more interested in that. Does anyone recognize this photo, by the way? This is going up in the ISS pretty soon. It's a project with a computing company called IBM, you may have heard of. This is a Watson AI that they have put into a little robot that will be floating in the ISS. Think about it as a version of Siri or Alexa, just in zero G and looking a little bit more disturbing. If you haven't seen my work, just a quick display of credentials. I run a project called the Future of Education Observatory. That is, we try to look at where education and technology are headed. And we do this through a variety of means, including an online book club, weekly video conference. I'll just show you some of those pieces. One of the outputs is a monthly trends analysis. This is a roughly 10-page look at current trends in education and technology. We've been doing this for almost 6 years now, so we have longitudinal data. We can take a look at these trends and extrapolate them forward. If you haven't seen it, just go to ftte.us. You'll see back issues and all kinds of examples. We track about 86 different trends. I'm not one of those presenters who will make you read a screen with type this small. I just put this up here so you can get a sense of the big picture. On the one hand, we take a look at what we call education in contexts. That's everything from education policy to enrollment to demographics to finance. We also, as you can see on the right, take a look at technology itself. So we cover everything from VR to mobile technology to social media and AI. We look at the intersection where education and technology intersect. And then we wrap this all together in a few mega trends. At the very top, we call it the higher education crisis. We also have a weekly video conference. How many of you have participated in this so far? Got a few? Good. It's called the Future Trends Forum. We use an experimental technology called Shindig, which so far has, if you're a technologist, has allowed for up to 200 simultaneous video inputs without any problem. It's pretty interesting to see. So we have a discussion about the future of education and technology. We bring in different people, different guests, and we have them talk about where this could go. I'm just the MC. I'm the host. I don't lecture or anything. It's a lot of fun to see. If you're in the LMS world, we had Martin Dugamis, the founder of Moodle there last summer. We have a wide range of folks. All of that is to say, we've been thinking about the future of education. And here are a few of the trends I'd like you to think about as you think about where technology could be going. Let's begin without talking about technology itself. One thing that's incredibly important to remember that we don't spend nearly enough time thinking about is that higher education is becoming more and more international. I don't mean this in the sense of everything is more globalized. I don't mean that. I mean, quite literally, we're seeing the emergence of a global market in higher education. We're seeing more and more faculty, more students, more content flowing across national borders. This has huge, huge results for the United States in all kinds of ways. So, for example, we're seeing other systems building up internationally. For example, you can trade credits between institutions more easily across Europe than you can within a single state in the United States, thanks to their higher education area. We see countries like China building up universities more rapidly than anything that anyone has ever done before. In fact, it's possible that China will soon outpace the U.S. in scholarly production. When we think about the future of education, when we think about the future of anything, we can talk about major trends. One of the most stable and durable trends is demographics. If you look at how many people exist, you can usually predict how many they will be and how they will live pretty reliably unless something extraordinary happens. So if we take a look at demographics, that can tell you some interesting things about education. One of them I'm sure you're all familiar with is that in the United States, our youth population is shrinking. People are having fewer and fewer kids. In fact, if we ended immigration right now, our population will be aging pretty rapidly. In my state, where I live in Vermont, the median age is about 45. That's true of several other states in the U.S. The flip side of this is our senior population is increasing in absolute numbers as well as in proportion, which is incredible. It's a fantastic achievement. I mean, this has happened because of great developments. How many of you are in healthcare or allied health in any way? It's partly because of you all, with tremendous advances in everything from medical care to public health. We also, all of you have participated, because if you work in education, we know the more education women get, the fewer kids and later in life they have. So the huge success of American higher education has helped change our demographics. So it's a great story, but it plays out in some interesting ways. To understand that, here are a couple of quick visualizations. This is human history until about 1950, and this is also what most of the developing world looks like. It's a population chart. Every slice here is about 4 or 5 years. If you look at the very bottom, where you see kids age 0 to 4, then 5 to 9, you see that humanity is really good about making babies. In fact, we kind of spam the environment with babies. And then mortality begins to set in year by year by year until you have very few elders. This pyramid structure is behind an awful lot of social events. This, for example, helps explain Confucian attitudes towards aging and family structures throughout East Asia. This, again, is what human civilization looked like up until very recently. This is Japan right now. That pyramid is inverted. You can see they have more teenagers than they have kids, more middle-aged people than kids, and then more seniors. And if you just imagine taking this forward further and further, you'll see that they're graying and graying more and more rapidly. Since Japan does not basically tolerate immigration at all, this chart helps explain why they were so brilliant at robotics, because they're running out of workers. They are pioneers in automation for elder care right now, for example. It's not just Japan. This is Germany. Most of the European Union is looking like this. Here's the United States, according to the Census Bureau. This is fascinating for us, by the way. If you think about America, we've normally thought of ourselves as a very young culture. You think about the baby boom, for example. But that is no longer the case. We are aging rapidly. Here is one prediction for the year 2020. I like to jokingly call this the refrigerator diagram. Instead of a pyramid, we have more even development. But just think about the implications of this. We've already seen some of the echoes. For example, in states like, well, your own, but especially Illinois, where pension obligations are becoming higher and higher, in part because people are living longer, there are more retirees, and there are fewer and fewer people feeding into the tax system. This is just one side effect. Think about your K-12 populations. And of course, think about 18-year-olds who go into traditional age undergraduate education. That pipeline is narrowing, and this has implications for everything we do. Just think, for example, the possibility that universities and colleges will start more aggressively recruiting older and older students. If that's the case, it makes sense for demographics, but that changes how we think about technology, among other things. Who we are, how old we are, is also changing, but so is where we live. For the past 40 years, we've had a steady migration out from the Northeast, away from the Midwest, and towards the Sun Belt. That hasn't changed yet, which is pretty interesting. Because you think about the diversity of, say, California versus Texas, our two biggest states, who have completely opposed everything in every way. And they're both huge success stories. They're kind of bipartisan success story. As opposed to New York, Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, which are just hemorrhaging people. If you take a look across both of those regions, that's where you see enrollment dropping. That's where you see colleges merging or closing. Behind all of this is the specter of economics. I just quickly want you to draw your attention to this one slide, because this is in some ways the most important one I can show you. This helps explain so much that has changed in our lifetime. Quick show of hands, how many of you were born before 1980? I'm not going to ask you to stand up. How many of you were born before 1970? Okay. Before 1960? Very good. How many of you were born after 2000? I'm not going to talk to you. This chart explains what happened in all of our lifetimes. This is a chart of income inequality. The vertical axis measures income inequality. The higher, the more unequal a society is. So to say 100% is Jeff Bezos and everybody else is unemployed. The horizontal axis is time. And take a look at this chart just for a second. On the left side, we have 1910. And you can see that we were pretty great in income inequality then. That's a Downton Abbey time period, right? But then from around 1914 to about 1960, income inequality plummeted. Now, this happened for a lot of obvious reasons if you think about it. World War I, World War II, the Great Depression destroyed a lot of wealth. And we also had huge social programs in all the, when I say we, by the way, this is the United States, but also several other Anglophonic countries, Canada, the U.S. You can see this as well happening throughout Western Europe. All these policies redistributed wealth. This is when the great, when the New Deal came out in the United States, for example, or national health care in Britain. So from around 1950 to about 1980, we were the least unequal we'd ever been. We still haven't realized the import of that. Some economic historians call this the Great Leveling or the Great Plateau. It's really extraordinary to take a look at housing, to look at mores in that period. By the way, this trough, this period, is when we overhauled, redesigned, and rebuilt all of American higher education. Federal financial aid, right from that period. The community college system, massively expanded then. Think about how many public universities and colleges became, went from being normal schools to being universities or colleges. Think how many expanded. Think about the idea that everyone should go to college, all piled right in that period. That's the system we inherited. And then, about 1980, income inequality started coming back. And look at that right edge. Depending on how you measure this, and there are a lot of ways we can talk about that, we are circa 1915, 1920 levels. And nothing is slowing that curve down. A Swiss bank, not exactly your average Marxist outfit, right? A Swiss bank says that right now we are living in a new gilded age. And that document that I found was their advice to investors. So they weren't exactly complaining, right? But that's vital to think about. Think about our expectations of students, of funding, of how we think about education. We built it in that middle trough. It's now obsolete. That's one of the reasons we were having so many stresses and so many challenges, is we are living in a different time. This informs almost everything we do. Now, also, other economic changes have changed how we do education. One of them is the big change in labor. So, for example, in most of your lifetimes, you know that we made this transition in the American economy from one driven by manufacturing to something else. In the 1990s, we were told we were going to move from manufacturing economy to the creative economy, to the information economy, the digital economy. And that was half true. We still make a lot of stuff. We still manufacture stuff. We just employ very few people to do it. We either use robots or we outsource it. We don't employ a lot of people in the creative industry. We don't employ a lot of people in technology. Those fields make a ton of money, but they only employ a handful of people. Where do most of us work these days? What sector? Software, you'd think, right? Service. The service industry defines American labor. That's one of the reasons why our wages and compensation have plateaued or declined, because they tend to be non-unionized, for example. It's a fascinating development that we really didn't anticipate or plan for. And again, that defines how we think about education, which is, after all, service industry. We've also shifted from the idea of having one job and one career for life to actually having multiple careers, multiple jobs, sometimes simultaneously. This is where we have the gig economy, for example, or what Australians call the American economy. And this is a huge change. If you think about the idea from the 1920s, say, you go to college, you get a degree, you go to work for an employer, you have this job, you do that for 50 years, and then you retire. Well, that's a weird thing to do these days. Now you go to college, perhaps when you're 25 or 30, you get one degree, maybe several, you have one job while you're doing another job, and then you jump to a third job. That's not how we planned higher ed. We may have to take lifelong learning a bit more seriously now. One more note. There's a lot to talk about on this subject. We can come back to it if you like. But automation is starting to impact this, just starting to impact this right now. We also have politics. And yeah, I used this slide when talking to an audience at Mexico City. And I brought this up complete silence. And then I said, I'd like to apologize for my nation, which has temporarily gone insane. And I got a standing ovation, like, right away. Yeah! I mean, it was interesting. Although what's fascinating is Mexican migration to the United States has been declining rapidly for the past 8 years. And in fact, one of the interesting side effects, reasons for that, is Mexicans' demographics are changing. They're beginning to age as well, as they are having fewer and fewer children. Interesting dynamic. But one thing to think about when you think about education is obviously we live in a time of political chaos and stress. I mean, you think about the different tensions that we are having right now between urban and rural, over race, over gender, over class, over nationalism. I mean, those tensions really, really occur throughout the United States. So think, for example, one side effect. I mentioned internationalization, right? We have all these international connections. We also have a lot of international students, except we have fewer now. The past 30 years, we grew the number of international students. The past 2 years, that number has declined. So if your institution relies on having international students for diversity purposes or for financial purposes, you are now suffering a bit as a result. That's one side effect. Think about how this will pull out over the next 4, 5, 10 years. Now, within education, we also have many reform movements trying to fix education, whether we like it or not, which is pretty interesting. You've experienced most of those, everything from race to the top, to having more and more accountability for a public institution. Those just keep going. We haven't seen any sign of slowing that down. A lot of Americans really respect and love education as a whole. They also think we're a major problem, we're doing things wrong and need to be fixed, which is a little unpleasant. We're kind of like a bad cat for the United States. We're also seeing the rise of new forms of certification, everything from micro-credentials and badging. And we're also seeing more and more experiments in creating new colleges and universities, everything from Mission U to Minerva to Dyson University. And who we teach keeps changing. This is fascinating. Last year, a Stanford dean published a book on students these days. I would love to tell you never to read it, because she's basing her entire model on Stanford undergrads, which is like saying, well, I live in Vermont, which is to say the United States. I mean, it's really, really skewed. And one of the reasons is our student population is changing rapidly. So, for example, we know that the traditional age student is dwindling this proportion, that we are having more and more adult learners. We call them non-traditional. That will stop at some point as they become simply traditional. We're seeing more and more first-generation students, which many of your institutions are trying to scramble with to support in many ways. The reason for that is we're trying to get more and more students in for various reasons. We're also seeing a growing number of veterans, which we try never to talk about, which I find gaspingly stupid. We are still fighting the longest war America has ever fought, which we rarely discuss anywhere, especially in higher education. But veterans organize online meticulously to figure out what schools to go to. And some colleges and universities have excellent support for them. On top of that, our students are increasingly afflicted with learning disabilities for reasons we sometimes understand and sometimes don't. Put all those together, we have a different student body than what we imagined in the 1960s. And obviously, the racial breakdown of our students is changing. The proportion who are white are dwindling. Above all, the two populations that are really, really growing are Asian American and especially Hispanic. That gives us, again, a very, very different student body than we've been working with. And this chart is one that keeps presidents, deans, and boards up nights. One of the things that's happened for the past 6 years that we don't really talk about nearly enough is the total number of students enrolled in American higher education has gone down. From about 1980 to about 2011, we tripled the size of students going to American education. I mean, incredible boom. It leaves the GI Bill and the land grants way behind. It's an extraordinary, extraordinary development. And then that stopped and has receded and gone down. Now, the biggest loss you can see here is in the for-profit sector. The for-profit sector basically boomed in the 90s. It has been collapsing like a rotten bag ever since. But we're not seeing growth anywhere else in any other sector. We're actually seeing the declines in some of them. Now, if your institution depends on revenue from tuition, like 99% of colleges and universities do, this is a problem, to put it mildly. If you're wondering about your travel budgets, if you're wondering about your software budgets or about your hardware refreshes or about your faculty compensation, this is one of the stresses on them. And this is not really reversing. Unless you find people who are really excited about spending more in college. Who is actually in this room? who's on your campus, who is teaching, who is supporting, is also changing. And one of the key dynamics of this is what happened to tenure. Basically, we used to think tenure was a good idea. We now don't think so. And by we, I mean academia, because we did this to ourselves. Here's one of many, many charts looking at the populations that grew on campus. And you can see on the very far left, the population that grew immensely was non-teaching faculty. That's administration, that's staff of all kinds, think librarians, technologists, deans, that kind of thing. The proportion that are tenure-track faculty barely grew at all. What really grew was the adjunct population. That is the normative professor in the United States. The typical instructor of higher education in the United States is to be determined. We did this to ourselves, and we keep doing it because we keep pumping out PhDs in record numbers. You all know this, I know. But it's important to think about because it reflects this, our change in labor. What happened with Uber drivers, what happened with unions, that's us too. And nothing is slowing this down. No State of the Union has said, you know, tenure is a good idea, we need more of it. Nowhere. There are a handful of colleges and universities which still have majority tenure-track faculty. They cling to that mostly for reasons of wealth. Beyond that, it's not happening. States are also responsible for something very, very interesting. And you can think about your state if you like, in Pennsylvania, which is we decided that we wanted more and more students to go through higher education and state governments would pay less and less for it. Kind of like the worst teenagers of all time. And you can see this across the board. It doesn't matter blue state or red state. It doesn't matter north or south. It's across the board. Again, my own state, pretty blue state. We tried to give you a president called Bernie Sanders. See how that worked out. We are 49th in the United States in supporting higher education, public higher education. That amount has dropped across the board. It's not coming back. How we pay for higher education? Well, you all know this. Quick show of hands. How many of you are still paying off student loans? Keep those hands up. Keep those hands up, please. Please, be clear. Look at that. We've never done this before in American history. In fact, no society has ever done this. We're number one. We invented this. I'm 51. My hand is up. It's possible that I will leave my loans to my children when I die. This chart here shows you the total amount. We're closing in at $1.4 trillion of student debt. No one is slowing this down, except for parents and students who are trying to avoid debt as much as possible. It's a fascinating problem, isn't it? You move on. By the way, women, you tend to spend more on debt. You tend to have more debt than men. One of the many pleasant side effects of this. So, my alternative title for this talk was Crunch Time. Higher education is being crunched in a massive way from all those different stresses. What happens to higher ed? Is this a bubble? Is this a crisis? Is this a panic? That's what we're deciding right now. I'm not trying to scare you. Well, I guess I am. I'm not trying to depress you. What I'm trying to do is give you the background behind what we do when we decide technologies, when we decide how to teach, when we decide flip classrooms or MOOCs or mobile computing or augmented reality. Everything I've said so far shapes all of this, and we don't talk about it enough. All those are trends. Let's talk about technology. This is a fun photo, by the way. This is called tabloid and tablet. I just like having that combination. So lots to talk about when we talk about technology. Obviously, we could do this for the next 3 days. We're going to do a lot of that for this conference, and I want to defer a lot to different people who are presenting. Huge forces in technology are still major. Obviously, mobile is enormous. Obviously, social media is huge. What I love reading about is hearing about how Facebook is dead. First of all, I would love to have a billion users and be dead. That's a problem I really want to grapple with. Second, why do I keep reading about that on Facebook? cloud computing used to be controversial, and we just moved there, basically. Digital video is possibly the world's biggest cultural output right now. We have political protests that are organized basically on how they will appear in Facebook and YouTube video. Nothing is slowing that down. The founder of JSTOR likes to drive me crazy. He tells me, think of video as the new paper. That's in many ways the direction we're headed. And computer gaming is an enormous industry. It's bigger than Hollywood. It influences everybody except for the Amish and academics. And we're still getting used to it. We also still think we have privacy to some extent. Snowden showed that we do not. And our response was to carry on without changing a damn thing at all, basically. If you think you're worried about privacy and you use one of these, I can laugh at you. One of the reasons I loved the Google Glass crisis was people said, oh, people would document it on their iPhones and say, look, they're ruining my privacy. They're doing it on iPhones. You don't understand this privacy word. Like in The Princess Bride, I don't think that word means what you think it means. But we can zoom into a little detail through some verbs. This is Kevin Kelly, one of the founders of Wired Magazine, interesting, odd person. He came up with a list of 8 verbs. As a former English professor, this makes me very happy, especially because they're gerunds. I want to focus on 4 of them. And these are the verbs that he thinks are powering changes in technology. These are, I think, pretty handy because they address everything. The ones I don't want to focus on are screening. We like using screens. Flowing, we like moving things around between different devices. Remixing, interacting, you know all about that. But let me show you these 4 bold ones. Accessing, where are you a librarian? Okay, so this is one of the forces that has changed your life right now. Forgive me if I ventriloquize this. We are happy to access rather than own media. How many of you listen to music on Spotify? How about Apple, what's it called? Apple Music? Apple Radio? Okay. How about YouTube?
Pandora.
I'm sorry?
Pandora.
Anybody else? So I can't use Pandora because I listen to 2 things. I listen to death metal and 19th century classical. And Pandora just freaks out. Do you want Mahler or do you want Venom? I don't know, man. But the interesting thing about this is none of you own any of that. Right? Pandora changed its mind? Too bad. Right? YouTube takes off my favorite, Boris Glutenov recording? I'm out of luck, right? It's like radio or like television. Think Netflix streaming. If we have box DVDs, forget them. We watch them on streaming. So my poor friend here, the librarian, used to be part of a profession that collected tremendous physical and digital collections that they would own and render access to you. Increasingly now, they collect agreements and service agreements between themselves and some licensor or content owner, like, say, JSTOR, for example, or ArtStore, or the Humanities eBook Project, and all of those as well. This is a huge change that just happened and seems to just keep accelerating, where we like to access rather than own. Here's the second one, sharing, or what lawyers quaintly refer to as rampant copyright violation. We love sharing stuff like mad, and we do it everywhere except in course management systems or in library software. And as you think, we like to share things on Pinterest, through social bookmarking, through Facebook, through Twitter. That's one of the major functions of Twitter, is sharing URLs and pointers to everything else. We love sharing stuff. We do it like crazy, and we'll keep doing this. 2 more trends. Cognifying. We like adding AI to our tools. And you can see this in everything from Google's autocomplete to looking at, say, Amazon's suggestion or recommendation engine. Imagine what happens if we add more and more intelligence or cognitive powers to your email, to your LMS, to your ERP systems. And also, we use more and more filtering. Those of you who are listening to Apple Music, do you use any of the playlists? Yeah, which, can you name 1 or 2 just off the top of your head?
New Age.
Yeah, okay, that's a good example. If you haven't seen this, these playlists are curated because when you look at the world of music, it's enormous, it's daunting. So they will actually curate a list for you, and you'll have some, like a DJ or a good musician who will come up with that list. I mean, I do this on YouTube. I have some really quirky lists that people can use. We like this idea of having playlists. We like filtering. In fact, it's possible, as Clay Shirky says, we're not facing information overload. We're facing filter failure. I mean, you think television, newspapers, radio used to do that for us. In fact, Netflix kind of does that for you as well. So think about this. If you take these verbs and apply these to technology, where we see more filtering, where we see more affordances for remixing and for sharing, where we see more tools that have more codification, all these together shape a different technology landscape than we're used to. And automation, some of you are going to be talking about automation as we go. I just want to quickly touch on automation and come back to it. Automation is really, really beginning to impact us in many, many ways. A Gallup poll asked humans in the United States, how many of you have used AI in the past week? It's 90% said yes. I read science fiction. I've read science fiction since I was a kid. I'm gratified. If you're not reading science fiction, by the way, you're probably not prepared for the 21st century. But automation, where are we seeing it? We're seeing it with drones. By the way, this is a drone with a chainsaw. Why? I have no reason. It's just cool to have that, right? We've seen drones with all kinds of things, including carrying people. There is a little people transport project that's coming out right now, which is pretty interesting. We're already used to robots. I love this map because it reminds people that Midwest exists. This is current deployment of robotics, and you can see that they're largely used in industries. Manufacturing. In fact, we have dark factories, factories that have no light because none of the robots use them. So they just work nonstop, which is pretty interesting. But we've seen them in industry. We've seen robots in cars with self-driving vehicles. In fact, California just now had two interesting developments. One was they decided to remove some of the legal restrictions on self-driving cars so it's easier to roll them out. And two, they've observed injuries that people inflict on autonomous cars. So there are stories of people who just walk up to a car and punch it and then move away. Or who push something against it and then move away. Watch for more of that. We also see robots at war. And everything from the war on terror to full-scale combat. This is an old dream. Some of you may think Terminator. And that's what we're working on. We're trying to use robots to replace humans for all kinds of reasons. And in fact, now we have an interesting legal problem. If a drone or a robot kills something the wrong way or blows up the wrong object, who's responsible? Now think about it. Is it the operator? If it's a is it a software generator? Is it the hardware manufacturer? It's an interesting dilemma. Again, a science fiction one. If you use the internet at all, you know that you are a second-class citizen because you're only a human. We don't make a lot of stuff. Robots produce more. So if you look at your spam filter, you realize how outnumbered you are by robots. They make more and more stuff. In fact, we've kind of passed the human age online in that way in many ways. We also have high-frequency trading. Anyone here been involved with that or looked into that at all? Yeah, what field are you in? Are you in economics?
No, I've heard it.
It's okay. You're among friends. Yeah. And yourself?
I'm associate
in the University of Florida. Excellent. Good for you. Well, I think good for you. Oh, it's good for you personally. Let me explain for everybody else. This is you can automate a lot of financial trading because a lot of it is based on very codifiable principles. I mean, think the oldest one, buy low and sell high. So people have written software that basically does that throughout the stock market and trading derivatives. So you have software programs that are buying and selling and impacting your economy. If you didn't know about this, your 401k has already been impacted. And in fact, some of these trading firms will physically move their hardware closer to each other so they can get, what, a femtosecond advantage on each other? It's extraordinary to see. This has already impacted the economy in some ways. And you can see impacting the academy because being able to work for those kind of sectors is a career path right now. Well, look at this slide. This is the 21st century of science fiction dreams. It's already happened. I'm a futurist. I'm telling you about the present. Take this slide and extrapolate it forward. Think about what this looks like in the far future, say 2 years from now. We also automated creativity. That is, we have software that helps you be creative, that makes things. So we've had software that writes journalism in sports, and in finance, and in meteorology. We also have software that can make creative stuff. Now here's a photo I took of a good friend of mine. He's a Canadian. He's trying not to look arrogant because he's a Canadian. He's always being very humble. I fed this photo into Google's Deep Dream Generator, and it produced a psychedelic masterpiece. And what's fun is you can take this and feed it back in, and it gets weirder and stranger, right? We already have software that writes screenplays, that writes place names. Already, we're just starting to get into this. You know, a little further forward. Okay, quick show of hands. I love doing this. This is so cruel. Quick show of hands. How many of you have iPhones? Here, now look how high the hands are, right? How many of you have Android phones? Not as many, and not as excited, but good for you. How many of you have Windows phones? Last time I was in Canada, I had to ask, how many of you have Blackberries? I do! They were so proud of that, right? One of the things about mobile that's so fascinating is I've been talking about this since 2001. I kept saying mobile is going to be big. People are like, are you sure? Yes, it's really, really huge. And now when you design for the digital world, you design for the mobile world first. So if you look at web pages that look simpler now, that's not because they think you're stupid. Unless they're CNN, Fox, MSNBC, in which case they assume you're stupid. What they assume is you're most likely to be reading it not on a big screen, but on a tiny one. so you can only have so many pictures at once. If you're looking at digital content on a desktop or a laptop, you're in many ways a second-class citizen. We have so many devices right now, it's truly extraordinary. Mobile devices in many ways. They keep unfolding and exfoliating in so many different forms and shapes. It's very, very difficult to keep track of. This is the Nielsen people who try and keep track of TV watching habits. And this is their attempt to quantify the different devices we use to watch TV. And you can see this is not exhaustive. That's already a large number. One of those device areas is virtual reality. And we're going to be talking about that here. Is it Dr. Denise will be talking? Is that you? Excellent. What time is your session?
3:30.
Excellent. So you should be there for this. Denise or Dennis?
Denise.
I want to just give you three possible ways virtual reality could unfold at a big, big, big level. Here's one. It could be scary. This event, if you know the story, this wasn't apparently scary. This is Mark Zuckerberg giving people free VR headsets, but it looks like something from 1984. And the reason it could be scary, because if you block out somebody's vision, that is automatically alienating for most people. It's very isolating and asocial so far. And also, when you're experiencing VR, you're generating a lot of data that can be nicely surveyed, managed, and sold back to you in all kinds of ways. So one possibility is a dark future for VR. Another possibility is that it will look stupid. This is the worst photo of technology taken in the past 20 years. I'm actually convinced this is an attempt to make VR look bad. I can't even do this posture. This is awful. But think about 3D TV, which died. Or think about 3D movies, which barely exist at all. And most of them are horrible. It's possible that VR will be, at most, a niche. It's possible that it won't get very far because it is expensive, it is difficult, we don't have a lot of content, and all these other problems. This is what I think is more likely as a future for VR. I love this photo dearly. Here we have the leader of the free world trying to be as cool as possible, as is his want, right? And at the same time, he is being watched by his secretary, who could care less. She's checking email, right? So it's an interesting spectacle that VR could simply become a work tool. What company right now do you think is the one that's making the most progress, making the most hardware, the most development in virtual reality? Which company is that?
Samsung?
No, you'd think, right? You'd think.
Microsoft.
The least sexy company on the planet. And they're doing great work, but we don't talk about it, it's Microsoft, right? I mean, they're doing fantastic work, but it's like Outlook. No one gets excited about it. We just use it. Or Windows. There aren't any Windows fans on Earth. No one has a Windows tattoo, you know? But it works. It simply works. And that's the stage we're in. That's what I think is most likely. I could be wrong. But I think we'll simply see VR as a tool that we use, that we will experience and we'll make things for. And we may not just go with that. When we go a little further forward, augmented reality is something most of you have experienced, where you take digital content and you tie it to the physical environment. So if you've ever used Yelp, for example, or Google Maps when you're walking or driving, you're not supposed to, but we do anyway. Or if you play Pokemon Go, or better yet, watch someone play Pokemon Go and look like they're going insane. Augmented reality and virtual reality combined yields mixed reality. So think about this. Have you used the HoloLens yet?
Yeah.
It's fascinating. Oh, understood. So put a little visor on your head, a small one, or goggles, basically. And hold your hands up. When you look through the visor, it superimposes digital content on the world in front of you. So you look at this wall, and you could say, paste a copy of Pandora. And Pandora will be playing music that maybe only you can hear. Over on the ceiling, you put a nice photo of a sunny beach, because you live in Philadelphia and it's a snowstorm, right? In front of you, on a table, you pull Excel, and you manipulate it with your hands. And you communicate with all of these by telling them, Pandora, pause. Picture, update. What's missing from this interface? Keyboard, mouse, physical screen. That computing technology works now. Think about how that changes things. Think about how that changes support, literacy, creativity. We're just starting to walk into this. My most recent book, I had a chapter of virtual reality storytelling because we're figuring this out. What does it mean to tell a story when you have this kind of environment? That's something to watch. That's something to pay careful attention to. Our ecosystem is getting more and more complicated. We're getting more and more devices that are smaller and smaller. This is why we have the Internet of Things. so we can have devices that are this tiny in its hardware environment. So imagine being in this room 2 years from now, and every single seat has a sensor that can tell if someone's sitting on it or not. Every seat can be tracked, can be measured, can be uploaded. In fact, we can give every seat in this room a Twitter account. That's not technologically very challenging. Imagine the entire environment being totally immersed in that kind of technology, being every object around you having a hyperlink or a URL. This is what we call the Internet of Things, which looks kind of bonkers in some ways. I mean, it's a security nightmare in all kinds of ways. We're not quite sure where it can go. But think about the pedagogy of this in the physical world. So imagine you're a student walking through campus, maybe walking through a city. Maybe you have environment information fed into your goggles, into your visor, into your contact lenses, telling you what you're looking at. We're able to upload content with a blink or a twitch or a voice command. Different objects in front of you, like a street corner or a car, may be thoroughly networked. The people around you may be inhabiting their own virtual world at the same time. I have to ask, is this a world that you're prepared for? Is this a world that you're planning for? When you teach mathematics, or when you teach virtual reality, or when you're listening to music, or simply being alive in the world? What I'm describing is science fiction light, because I'm also describing journalism that describes the world around us. We have so much to talk about. We have so many ways that technology can unfold. We have so many different ideas. And you are in a great spot because you're in a room and a conference surrounded with people who are experimenting and exploring with these ideas right now. I'm conscious of time, and I'm conscious of doing a terrible thing, which is talking too much. What I'd like to ask you to do in the last couple of minutes that we have left to us is to say, of all these different trends that I've pointed out, the wild technologies, the terrifying economics, which of these trends looks most significant to you, where you sit, where your work is, as a librarian, as a faculty member, as a technologist?
So that's it for today. I hope you enjoyed the keynote talk by Dr. Alexander. Don't forget to check my show notes to see links to his websites, including his Future Trends Forum. Highly recommend it. Until next time, have a great week.
That's it for today's episode. Thank you very much for listening. Don't forget to give Rod feedback. You can leave comments on his blog or send email to rod@rodspulsepodcast.com. The preceding audio commentary is the product of the author, Dr. Rodney Murray, and does not represent the official viewpoint of the University of the Sciences or any other institution or company.